then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more pour for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's July the 11th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, let's start off with a few quick notes here. Now, I'm making this on Tuesday morning, July the 9th, and as of yesterday, July the 8th, Edgar Steele was supposed to have a hearing on his appeal in the Ninth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals sitting in Portland, Oregon. Steele is appealing on a variety of grounds, but mainly on the grounds that the entire United States government case against him is a monumental barrel of horse dung from beginning to end. The Ninth Circuit is also known in legal and political shorthand as the Nutty Ninth, because their justices are so far to the left. Well, put it this way, their actual official seat or home bench or whatever it's called with judges is in San Francisco, which should tell you something. Now, in any case, I'm not sanguine about the chances of a bunch of raving hippy-dippy 60s retreads in black robes giving a white nationalist of any kind a fair hearing. But we'll see how it plays out. And we probably won't have a decision for some months. Interestingly, the Steeles were able to hire another attorney named Dennis Reardon to actually argue the case in front of the Nutty Ninth, kind of reminiscent of the British practice of hiring a solicitor to do the paperwork while a barrister actually argues the case in court. Apparently, this Reardon guy has a pretty good track record in prior cases for persuading the Nutty Ninth to see something resembling reason. Now, secondly, to the person who sent me the two yellow legal pages at the Seattle box, informing me in great detail about all the things that I'm doing wrong, and telling me all about how I'm a terrible leader, and you're so bitterly disappointed, and you're renouncing me forever because I'm so wicked and evil, and you're not going to support me anymore. Well, I'm sorry to hear that. I have to say, though, that I would be a lot more impressed with your impassioned renunciation if I had any idea at all as to who the hell you are. You tell me you've got this big government job and career that would be in danger if so much as a whisper of your interest in the NF were to get back to your bosses. And, yep, I can see that. There's a lot of jobs like that, and I can understand why you would be leery of that possibility. And if you want to pull your head back in because something has spooked you, fine. Now, that kind of thing happens to me all the time, believe me. But I don't get the two-page letter of denunciation, and even more to the point, I don't understand why you seem to think that I'm going to be so shattered and devastated by it that I will come stumbling to you on my knees on this program or otherwise and beg you with tears in my eyes to come back. Dude, hate to break it to you, but you were never really here. Now, you clearly place more concern on your own personal safety than on the survival of your race, and okay, you're not alone in that. God knows there are millions of white people with the same pathology, and that pathology of combined fear and narcissism is one of the reasons that we're in the racial mess we're in. But if you got spooked and you wanted to leave, why not just fall silent, like a lot of people do? Why the two-page letter that reads like a 14-year-old breaking up with her boyfriend? Now, just for the record, guys, for those of you who do want to get involved with the NF, I mean really involved, I have to tell you that there's no way to do that anonymously, if for no other reason than the fact that we are under surveillance as if we were in a goldfish bowl. Or we try not to make it possible anyway to get involved with us anonymously for our own security. Now, if I'm going to exchange emails or letters with somebody beyond simple one-line messages about books or whatever, I intend to know who the hell I'm talking to, at least insofar as that's possible on the internet. Now, the same applies to anonymous letters in the mail. Because they're anonymous, I tend to completely disregard them. If someone wants to involve themselves in our affairs, but they refuse to give us any idea as to who they are, what their background is, what baggage they're carrying, and for whom, and what agenda they're following, then that for us is a big, huge red flag. Yes, I know, all of this may sound contradictory after all my talk about conspiratorial method and Andy's upcoming talk about meeting security, but if you'll sit down and actually think things through, the dawn will come. Now, remember the difference between security consciousness and paranoia. Security consciousness helps you fulfill your racial mission. Paranoia prevents you from being effective. As contradictory as what I may say on here may sound like at times, it's not, really, if you'll think about it. Courage has to be balanced with common sense. Revolutionaries have to function, and yeah, while that means not jumping up on a table in the break room during lunch and waving a tricolor and giving your co-workers a white racial harangue, it also means not hiding down so deep that you don't actually do anything. Kind of like how leaderless resistance turned out in the end to be all leaderless and no resistance. How lone wolf turned out to be all lone and no wolf. Now, I suppose that the best way to put it is that you guys need to decide which is more important to preserve, your race or yourself. And you need to make that decision before you even approach us. Yes, I know, many times you have to do one or else you can't do the other, but at some point in time, you have to take risks with yourself and your secret in order to do things for the 14 words. Now, if preserving your own skin and keeping your own horrible, politically incorrect secret that your mind is not completely under control is the most important thing in your life, you probably need to rethink your involvement with us. And there's no need to send me any 2-page letters on yellow legal pads about it.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. I need to talk to you all about a security issue which repeatedly crops up from time to time within the party. This is the sort of topic we have a hard time covering because it's quite easy to do face to face, but I have to be very circumspect since not everyone listening in is friendly. For those of you who are new, you'll hear this idea a lot. The Northwest Front is a legal political organization which must behave as if it is an illegal one. On a very practical level, this means, among other things, we don't actually have the rights we habitually exercise on a day-to-day basis. Today, we're going to talk about our freedom of association, or rather, our lack thereof. Before I really get going, I need to take my hat off to our Portland, Oregon crowd. I can't give specifics, largely because I don't know every single one of them, and actually, that's the way it ought to be. Mr. Covington's mentioned it before, but our Portland people are the sort who want to get after the business of the 14 words. Before I became racial, I did plenty of political work out in public, and most of it was very confrontational. I completely understand and support you when you guys get the urge to go out and about. So far, from what I'm told, it's been done correctly, too. When I started planning this material, I knew there were several people who would each think I'm talking about them specifically, and that's not at all the case. If anything, I'm trying to encourage proper use of positive tendencies such as serious public activity. This is aimed at everyone since it's something we all have to be concerned about. The party has put out enough material on exactly why movement-style public rallies, conferences, and the like are a bad idea, and we're going to stick by that. They're very serious targets for all sorts of paid informants and anti-white agitators. Very frequently, these events are targeted in order to acquire photographs of white racists and use whatever is on hand to identify our people. Frequently vehicle license plates, but that's just one possibility among many. I've been told by quite a few people in the party they're able to put up with the harassment and other issues brought about by possible exposure. This seems especially true in certain cases because some of our people are already known to the public as white nationalists. I'm willing to take them at their word, since everyone who claims this seems to be doing just fine, and had left us Portland of all places. But going only that far and no further misses something very critical about the conspiratorial method. When I make the choice to praise one thing and criticize something else, it's because I have a set of criteria I use to weigh options. Of course, I'm referring to the come one, come all gatherings of the older movement, as opposed to something where there's a limited, exclusive, and strict invitation process. For example, I started working on this material sometime before meeting up with some party comrades in Oregon a number of weeks ago, and that sort of meeting, for those of you who were there, is explicitly not what I'm talking about right now. We have certain precautions for those, yes, but that's not something I'll go into on Radio Free Northwest, since there really do have to be some boundaries for what's safe on the air. I don't have time to dive into my decision-making criteria on the air, nor would I want to. Those of you curious might get a hold of the party reading list and learn from the real masters of asymmetric warfare by reading the books they wrote, which we now recommend to you. Very briefly, I'll point out that I know what our objective is, the Northwest American Republic. I know approximately what set of procedures, as outlined in the Northwest Independence novels, are required to produce said republic. Therefore, my primary task is to help shepherd the Northwest Front to the point where it is a fighting revolutionary party capable of creating this new nation. In order to do that, I must at least understand and adopt some of the tactics and procedures which are required during the time we must not speak of. Of course, we use legality as a tactic, so I cannot break the law. I can only adopt tactics related to security and other concerns. This is where I draw my personal requirements from and how I advise on various situations and problems when asked by my comrades to do so. After all, if we're going to accomplish our goal of securing our existence and a future for white children, we must begin acting as if we're serious about doing so. This brings me to my observation. If we're not playing around here in the Northwest, and, point of fact, we're not, we must first understand our objective will one day be reality and plan accordingly. According to our plans, those involved with the Northwest Front right now will play a critical role in the near future and afterward in our political efforts. This, among other things, means we must start acting like political leaders and political soldiers by taking real responsibility for the things we do. Is an appearance at a very lax and very public movement conference of any sort a responsible thing to do? Certainly not. Leadership responsibility is something which falls on everyone in the homeland who associates with the party. No exceptions. Taking responsibility for the party includes guaranteeing we'll be here tomorrow and newcomers receive a better introduction to the Northwest Front than you were given. Further, it means making sure those less experienced than yourself don't make the same mistakes you made and are protected from naive errors to which the newly racial are prone. A very large part of this is being an example of good judgment. By now, it should have dawned on you where I'm taking this. If you are made or otherwise compromised by attending a meeting you had no business at in the first place, then you're putting the comrades around you at risk. Even if you're already known, being connected with the Northwest Front in the public mind puts all the comrades you associate with in possible danger as well. A comrade recently reminded me we're not running a risk-free operation, and he's very, very correct. To reply, it's also the case we can't take a risk of this nature. When the Irish Republicans put on demonstrations, those actually involved in the IRA were forbidden to go anywhere near them for very obvious reasons. One day, hopefully soon, we'll be in the position where we're managing public personalities. But if the party isn't ready to do that, then certainly the individuals at risk aren't ready to handle the limelight. Before you feel the need to run off to a conference or gathering which is not safe to attend, please think about those you might affect in a very negative way. As a responsible Northwest nationalist, I'm concerned with the good of all those associated with the party, and you must be as well. Even if you're already known to our enemies, please understand my cautionary words aren't on your behalf, but on the behalf of those who are not yet known. When I make decisions about party political activity, one of the factors I must consider is the well-being of all those who will come after me, and it's no different for any other Northwest nationalist. Hail victory, comrades.
Okay, tomorrow is the glorious 12th of July in Northern Ireland, the marching season as it's called. And so, as I promised, we'll be showcasing Orange Protestant music from the North, even though our first artists here are some of the most famous musicians ever to come out of the Catholic South, the Clancy Brothers.
Seeing as it's near the 17th of March, we're going to extend a hand to our orange brethren. With a black spot on it. No, you see, in the north of Ireland, we have a bunch of fellas called orange men, and they're fellas that sell oranges. Lemons? Now, this fella in our hometown, he was an orange man. And he was going with this girl. She was a Catholic. They're the bad fellas, and we're the good fellas. And they decided to get married, so they got married. And after we were married a little while, he decided he was going to become a Catholic. So he went to the priest, and he took instructions for a long time, and he was baptized eventually. And he came home, but he couldn't get it through his head that he was a Catholic, and he didn't know what the hell to do about it. So he went to the priest, and he said, "Now look, Father," he said, "I know I took all them instructions, and you baptized me and everything, but I can't get through my head that I'm a Catholic. What'll I do about it?" So the priest says, "Well, see Norman Vincent Peale." No, he didn't say that. He said, the only thing I can tell you to do is keep repeating to yourself, "I'm a Catholic, I'm not a Protestant, I'm a Catholic, I'm not a Protestant, I'm a Catholic, I'm not a Protestant, I'm a Catholic, I'm not a Protestant." Eventually it'll penetrate your thick skull that you're a Catholic and not a Protestant. So away he went muttering to himself, "I'm a Catholic, I'm not a Protestant, I'm a Catholic, I'm not a Protestant, I'm a Catholic, I'm not a Protestant." Now, the following Friday, the priest happened to be going around, and he decided to visit the newlyweds. And he went in, and he got a whiff he shouldn't get in a good Catholic house on a Friday. And Mary was sitting knitting, and he says to her, "Where's Sam, Mary?" He said, "He's in the kitchen, Father." So he walked into the kitchen, and there was Sam, and he had a huge, big steak on the pan, and he was scooping gravy over it, and he said, "You're a trout, you're not a steak, you're a trout, you're not a steak, you're a trout." The song is called "Your Trout, You're Not a Steak." No, it's called "The Old Orange Flute." A fish. In the county Tyrone, near the town of Dungannon, where many's eruption, myself had a hand in, Bob Williamson lived, however betrayed, and all of us thought him a stout orange blade. On the 12th of July, as it yearly did come, Bob played with his flute to the sound of a drum. You may talk of your harp, your piano, or lute, but there's none could compare with the old orange flute. But Bob the Deceiver, he took us all in. He married a papist called Bridget McGinn, turned papish himself and forsook the old cause that gave us our freedom, religion and laws. Now the boys of the place made some comment upon it, and Bob had to fly to the province of Connaught. He fled with his wife and his fixings to boot, and along with the latter, his old orange flute. At the chapel on Sunday, to atone for past deeds, said pathers and aves and counted his beads, till after some time, at the priest's own desire, he went with the old flute to play in the choir. He went with the old flute to play for the mass, but the instrument shivered and sighed, "Oh alas." And try though he would, though it made a great noise, the flute would play only the Protestant boys. Bob jumped and he started and got in a flutter, and threw the old flute in the blessed holy water. He thought that this charm would bring some other sound. When he tried it again, it played "Croppies Lie Down." And for all he would whistle and finger and blow, to play papish music he found it no go. Kick the Pope and boil water, it freely would sound, but one papish squeak and it couldn't be found. At the council of priests that was held the next day, they decided to banish the old flute away. They couldn't knock heresy out of its head, so they bought Bob a new one to play in its stead. Well, the old flute was doomed, and its fate was pathetic. 'Twas fastened and burned at the stake as heretic. As the flames soared around, they heard a strange noise, as the old flute still whistling the Protestant voice.
Toodle-a-dee, toodle-a-dee, oh, it's 6 miles from Bangor to Donaghadee.
Good evening, comrades. Recently, I've been very eager to discuss a more contemporary topic, and there's this small book called Nova Europa by Arthur Kemp. This is a book that's going to concentrate on two examples. One is the example of Orana, and the other is the example of Israel. Now, it starts out by saying that North America, Australia, and Western Europe are really being overrun. It says that the situation is somewhat better in certain parts of Eastern Europe, not so much the former Soviet Union, because they're also being somewhat overrun, but countries such as Poland are really the best off. And it actually says at one point that there's a question of where a European ethnostate should be, and there's even some that think possibly in an Eastern European country where they are looking for a higher population. It says that the thing about democratic participation, it's difficult because of demographics and also because there's a need to cater to various lobbies. But the author feels that activism is important to spread the message. So the author is one that is still interested in this idea of awakening people. But the author does admit that there have been 60 years of failure, and the author attributes poor leadership and propaganda, but says the reasons really don't matter. Really, in the U.S., power is completely lost, and the reality is, the harsh reality really throughout the world is that many whites cannot be saved or helped, so we need to concentrate on those that can. Now, the argument made in this book is for indigenous rights. It's for self-recognition, and it really stresses that there has to be an abandonment of this idea of comparison. A lot of times in this movement, we say one thing is better than another, but the modern mind has really lost its taste for that kind of comparison. And when we make a lot of value judgments, that just tends to turn people off. So we need to stick to the message of autonomy for self-defined ethnic groups. And the author is also against something he calls necropolitics, and that is resurrecting symbols either from World War II or from the Civil War. And well, there's an argument to be made for that. I often think there's two opposite arguments. And one argument is the argument that the author makes. And another argument I see is the argument that, well, if you're upset about seeing certain symbols, then maybe you're not really salvageable. So there are those two arguments. But then again, there are people who use symbolism or use the movement for the wrong things, as was mentioned in Bill White's book about how some people are really sadistic or something, and they use the symbols in the wrong way. So that's also food for thought. So it's a very understandable frame of mind. Now, recently I went to the Orana website, and it's a very sort of neutral, it's a very clean, it doesn't have any inflammatory symbols. And in fact, the symbol for Orana is so nice but so bland that it almost looks like it would be an orange juice company. I mean, that's what I would think if I saw that symbol, if I didn't know what Orana was. The history of Orana specifically was that it was a piece of land that apparently there had been some people living there, but in 1991, a large portion of it was bought from one of the local water departments. And it was picked for demographic reasons, and it was also a very out-of-the-way area. And really, it's still very remote. One of the Boshoffs says that independence is the goal, but they have to be realistic about it. Now, the steps that the author puts forward is the author talks about choosing an area where you have the right to settle, persuading others to move, and to create a substantial presence. Establish control as much as possible and formal recognition, even if private. And over time, the practical and symbolic way is the experience of freedom. Now, you can either approach this state first or people first. The state embodies a psychological condition. So I almost don't see the difference in a way, or you have to do whatever is practical. Now, in terms of Orana, they've decided that real power comes from demographic possession, and it's better to deal with current reality than to provoke an unwinnable conflict, and that's what they're trying their best to do in Orana. And the third point is that independence is a daydream if the majority doesn't support it. So I really find the project very fascinating. I've tried to learn all I can about that community. I won't say that there's a ton of information out there, and I do worry about the Orana community because there are some people who just hate the idea of any type of white community. And, you know, in an unstable place like Africa, I do have some concerns, but I think they're doing what they can. Now, the second example it uses is the one of Zionism. It says that Zionism has its positive and negative aspects. Now, the positive aspects would be Jewish unity and support from the Jewish lobby, but the negative would be the displacement of native peoples. Now, it says that the problem that they have had clearly with Israel is that because they displaced Palestinians, there's been this constant conflict going on. When they considered making Israel, when Theodor Herzl really was promoting Zionism, there was another possibility. In South America, they were considering making an Israel there. But because the original land of Israel really captured the imagination of Jewish people, that ended up being the choice, even though it was the more difficult to implement. And it does say that that is another factor in finding a homeland. And it also mentions the fact that in the former Soviet Union, they also tried to make a Jewish homeland. But it was a very remote area that a lot of people didn't want to move to. So that's the downside of a remote area. And it didn't really have any meaning for Jewish people. So it never really took off. And today, it's actually only 10% Jewish. Now, interestingly, we often talk in this movement about how we oppose Zionism. However, from 1929 until 1939, Reinhard Heydrich, who was a National Socialist, was involved in training Jews to become farmers and then smuggling them into Palestine through Turkey. So actually the National Socialists, or at least some of them, liked the idea of Israel because they wanted to get Jewish people out of Germany and into Israel. It talks about how Israel worked on gaining independence. First of all, you have to have a concept, you have to select a territory, you have to have some kind of infrastructure, democratic favor, and then formal immigration, and the sixth being seek recognition and be prepared, it may take decades. I was doing some further research on the net to look into how they made Orana. Originally, this land for Orana was purchased for $1.6 million, but now it's worth, well, it was in rands, South African currency, but it went from $1.6 million to $500 million. They have a lot of agriculture there, and of course the Boers have always been farmers. They're very eco-friendly. They have educational choices. The educational choices can either be self-driven or traditional, and they offer a lot of different types of housing for residents. Now, one of the ways they get around any legal problems is that in their case, they don't write in any specific discrimination at all. But they note that if a non-person, for example, tried to move in, they would soon find themselves out of step with the community and they would move on. Also, it is a private company and they keep any employment situations very small. They always have a minimum number of employees, and then when a business grows too large, they'll split into various branches. Now, one possible danger is that the government of South Africa could, in theory, bring low-income housing near the town, but it's not too likely because they're very isolated. As far as other South Africans, they're really having a very difficult time. There are some South Africans that do not like Orana. Some find it too remote. Others find it too religious because Orana is very traditional and the Boers are very Christian. So I just thought that was an interesting book and also a website that you can go to. And if you purchase the book, they'll give you the website. And the address is basically Project Nova Europa. And then there's also, you can just type in www.orana.co.za and find the Orana website. And they do have a link program where if you post their link and you tell them that you posted their link, then they'll link to your site. So I do occasionally like to keep things current with books like this. So thank you very much for listening.
A few years ago, almost every week on Radio Free Northwest, I'd run what might be called historical audios as part of a process of letting newer and younger comrades learn something about our movement's history and indeed the fact that we have one. I ran clips from people like Father Coughlin, Gerald L.K. Smith, Commander Rockwell, and Bob Matthews, but one of my favorite historical characters in our movement is the Kingfish himself. Now, the closest that we have ever gotten to a genuine folkish revolutionary leader in this country was Huey Pierce Long. He was born in 1894, and he was murdered by the Jews in 1935. Huey was known as the Kingfish. He was governor of Louisiana, and later he was a United States senator. Now, Long has always been a complex and fascinating figure to all who study his life and his career. The Kingfish was unquestionably an egotist and a power-hungry personality who ruthlessly trampled over everyone who got in his way, no question on that. He was one of the most skillful machine politicians in American history. He was a master manipulator who became one of the greatest practitioners of the corrupt democratic system of patronage, bribery, corruption, extortion, and deception. On several occasions, he called out the Louisiana National Guard to intimidate his political opponents, who were, frankly, rather in need of intimidating, if the truth be known. When he left for the United States Senate in 1932, Huey handpicked his own successor as governor, a flunky named O.K. Allen, who was so feckless that a legend arose that a leaf once blew in through the window and landed on his desk in the State House, and Allen signed it. But even Huey Long's worst enemies have never denied that the Kingfish manifested throughout his whole life a profound love, respect, and concern for the white Southern working class. The factory workers and sharecroppers and manual laborers who, in that day as in this, bore the brunt of taxation, conscription in time of war, cynical political exploitation, black crime, and arrogant patronizing discrimination by the wealthier classes in the South who, from the time of slavery, had used the black presence as a source of cheap labor to keep the white workers' wages low and as a potential threat to keep the poor whites in line. For the poor whites to rock the boat, to break with the bourbons of the planter class, always risked weakening or damaging the social and legal mechanisms of control, with the ever-present danger that the blacks might be turned loose to rob and rape and kill, and indeed that's what happened in the 1950s, and that situation prevails to this day in the South and throughout the rest of the country. But in Huey Long, the white workers no longer had a boss, but a true friend in a position of power. The wealthy, liberal elite, the New World Order of the era, never forgave Long for it, and eventually they murdered him. Long began his battle for white rights in the 1920s when he was elected to the relatively minor position of state railroad commissioner. By raising carriage rates for large corporations, notably the all-powerful Standard Oil, and by improving pay, benefits, and conditions for the railroad workers, Long incurred the anger of the power structure. Twice, they tried unsuccessfully to indict Long and remove him from office, but being a skilled courtroom attorney as well as a politician, Huey beat him back. Elected governor in 1928, Long provided widespread employment for both races through road building and swamp drainage projects. He further enraged the rich and powerful by providing free textbooks and lunches for all Louisiana school children, which in those days was a positively revolutionary concept since many white working class children couldn't go to school because their parents couldn't afford to buy books. Now, in the little bayou town of St. Martinsville, Long made one of the most famous addresses in American political history, the Evangeline Speech, which is one of the most searing indictments of liberal democracy ever delivered by an American political leader. Long was speaking to a crowd of French Cajuns, the despised white minority of Louisiana, whom the liberal journalists of that day as well as this patronized, mocked, and abused, and whom the wealthy upper class of that day as well as this generally considered to be quote-unquote lower than niggers. Now, I looked around all over the internet trying to find some recording of Long actually making this speech. I don't think it was recorded at the time, or else repeating it on a radio station, something like that. I wasn't able to find something, so I'm going to have to try and read this myself. Here beneath this oak, Evangeline waited for her lover, who never came. This is a spot made immortal by Longfellow's poem, but Evangeline is not the only one who has waited here in disappointment. Where are the schools that you have waited for your children to have, which have never come? Where are the roads and highways that you send your money to build and which are now no nearer than before? Where are the institutions to care for the sick and the disabled? Evangeline wept bitter tears in her disappointment, but they lasted only through a single lifetime. Your tears in this country, around this oak, have lasted for generations. Give me the chance at last to dry the tears of those who still weep here. Now, you have to imagine this is on a hot Louisiana day, and Huey's standing up on the stump really orating. You'll hear him speak in a bit, and you'll understand what his style was like. Anyway, Long won the election by a landslide. As a United States senator, Long began to widen his appeal onto a nationwide level in preparation for a presidential bid against Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1936. Huey built his own national organization through his books, Every Man a King, and My First 100 Days in the White House, and also through his Share the Wealth clubs, whose slogan was, Every man a king, but no one wears the crown. Long advocated a highly revolutionary and populist program involving not just the restriction of capitalist excesses and better individual conditions for working people, but the actual redistribution of existing wealth, something only Adolf Hitler has ever been able to achieve without mass slaughter. And yes, I know I bitch about the Democrats and Obama trying to redistribute white people's wealth to people with black and brown skins. The difference is that what Long wanted to do was redistribute the wealth of a small handful of filthy rich millionaires and give it to white working people. Long's breathtakingly simple plan was to place a legal limit of $1 million on annual income for individuals, as well as a cap of $10 million on the individual net worth of any one American citizen. It never would have passed through Congress, and he never would have been able to do it, but by 1930 standards, and even today, this is more than enough money to maintain an individual and his family in the most magnificent luxury. But by advocating this idea, Long signed his own death warrant. On the night of Sunday, September the 8th, 1935, Huey Long was shot dead in the corridors of the Louisiana State House by a Jewish doctor named Carl Austin Weiss. The assassin was himself immediately gunned down by a Louisiana State Police detective assigned to guard the senator. Now, despite several half-hearted attempts by subsequent politically correct authors to prove that Weiss was innocent, an exhumation and autopsy on Long's body in 1993 proved that the fatal bullet which killed Long did indeed come from Weiss's .32 automatic, and not, as has been alleged, from the weapon of one of Long's bodyguards. No credible motive has ever been unearthed as to why Carl Austin Weiss sat down and ate his Sunday dinner, played with a family dog, and then stuck a pistol in his pocket and took a stroll over to the state capitol to kill the United States senator. Born a Jew, Weiss converted to Catholicism and married into an upper-crust French Roman Catholic family. It's been lamely suggested that Weiss was upset at an insult to his father-in-law, a prominent judge on the part of Senator Long, i.e. that the judge, and hence Weiss's wife, had Negroid blood in them, but no one's been able to come up with any documentary proof that any such allegation was ever made by Long or anybody else. The system occasionally portrays Weiss as a Roman Catholic and doesn't mention his Jewish heritage. All I can say to that is Google Carl Austin Weiss on the internet and take a look at that face and see what you think. Now, the most likely explanation is that the established power structure had decided that Huey Long had to die, and Carl Weiss drew the short straw. It was common knowledge in Louisiana's elite circles that Standard Oil was plotting to kill Long and had allocated a large sum of money for that purpose. In Huey Long, white working people lost a leader who was arguably the only real friend they have had in any position of power during the past 80 years. To this day, the whites of Louisiana have exhibited a stubborn, rebellious streak, such as when they cast huge vote totals for David Duke in recent years. And to this day, any mention of Huey Long's name will bring thunderous cheers from any gathering of Louisiana white people.
Starting in life in this ramshackle house, Long ranted and raved his way into the chief executive's chair of the sovereign state of Louisiana. His career was a stormy, violent journey through the sometimes puzzling maze of political life. He was never without his bodyguards, confessing to friends that he fully expected to die at the hands of an assassin when his time was up. His feuds were monumental, like the time that the mayor of New Orleans crossed swords with the fiery governor. Voters at the city election had to be protected by the militia as a result of that one. But as far as the man on the street was concerned, Huey Long could do no wrong. And the Kingfish loved a parade, like this one on the way to an LSU football game. Huey had built the famous university, and it was his pride and joy, particularly its football teams.
We have opened up night schools to educate the adult illiterates. We have paved the highways. We have built free bridges. We have built a new capital. We have taken the insane out of the jail cells and placed them in modern institutions. We have eliminated barbarism. We have shut down the lotteries. We have closed up the gambling dives. We have abolished the vice area. And now, the corporate element of this state that were cheek for jowl, hand in hand with them, who profited by it, who ransacked this state for the element of their allies, are being told what they can do and what they can't do, what they will pay, what they can't keep from paying for the welfare of the people of Louisiana. And we expect to have this state ruled by the people and not by the Lord and the interests of high finance.
He was a vital man who had the common touch of a backwoods politician. His flaming oratory plummeted him up the political ladder at an alarming rate. In 1933, there was even talk of a Long for President movement in the next election. His theme song, Every Man a King, became Louisiana's unofficial state anthem. Huey himself had a hand in writing it. But his meritorious rise to fame and power that carried him as far as the United States Senate ended in the state capitol building in Baton Rouge, just as he himself had prophesied. This was his assassin, Dr. Carl A. Weiss, Jr., a prominent Baton Rouge eye specialist. Weiss, shown here in an earlier pleasure cruise, was reputed to have met Long in the capitol and fired a fatal Luger bullet into his side. 2 days later, on September 10th, 1935, Huey Long was dead. His widow was appointed to fill out his term as United States Senator. She accepted the commission from the governor as Louisiana joined her in mourning the passing of its champion, the kingfish, Huey Long.
Which we have assembled, it is our estimate that 4% of the American people own 85% of the wealth of America, and that over 70% of the people of America don't own enough to pay the debts that they owe. How many men ever went to a barbecue and would let one man take off the table what's intended for 9/10 of the people to eat? The only way you'll ever be able to feed the balance of the people is to make that man come back and bring back some of that grub he ain't got no business with.
Now, how are you going to feed the balance of the people? What's Morgan and Baruch and Rockefeller and Mellon going to do with all that grub? They can't eat it. They can't wear the clothes. They can't live in the house. Give them a yacht. Give them a palace. Send them to Reno and give them a new wife when they want it. If that's what they want. But when they've got everything on the God's living earth that they can eat and they can wear and they can live in, and all that their children can live in and wear and eat, and all their children's children can use, then we got to call Mr. Morgan and Mr. Mellon and Mr. Rockefeller back and say, come back here. Put that stuff back on this table here that you took away from here, that you don't need. Leave something else for the American people to consume. And that's the problem. We're not going to destroy the Gulf Refining Company. We're not going to destroy the Standard Oil Company, but we're going to say that the limit of any one man's stock ownership in the Standard Oil Company is from $3 to $5 million to that individual, and that the balance of the people of America own the balance of what the Standard Oil Company is worth. All right. Then we start from the bottom, that the 25 or more million American families shall have a homestead, a home, and the comforts of a home, including an automobile and a radio, the things it takes in that house to live on. We say to America, 125 million, none shall be too big, none shall be too poor, none shall work too much, none shall be idle. No luxurious mansions empty, none walking the streets, none impoverished, none in pestilence, none in want, but in the land blessed by the smile of the Creator, with everything to be consumed, to be eaten, to be worn, that America will become a land sharing the fruits of the land, not for the favored few, not to satisfy greed, but that all may live in a land in which the Lord has provided an abundance sufficient for the luxury and convenience of the people in general, I think. The Democratic Party and the Republican Party were just like the old patent medicine drummer that used to come around our country. He had two bottles of medicine. He'd play a banjo and he'd sell two bottles of medicine. One of those bottles of medicine was called High Papa Laurel. And another one of those bottles of medicine was called Low Papa Howell. Finally, somebody around that said, is there any difference in these medicines? Oh, he said, considerable. They're both good, but they're different.
He said that high popolorum is made from the bark off the tree that we take from the top down. And that low popolorum is made from the bark that we take from the root up. And the only difference that I have found between the Democratic leadership and the Republican leadership was that one of them was skinning from the ankle up and the other from the ear down when I got to Congress.
You folks may remember that a while back I asked for people in the British Isles or elsewhere to send me music clips of orange flute bands, parades from the Glorious Twelve, Apprentice Day marches, so forth and so on. Anything with the orange flutes and the lambegs. One guy loaded me up with them. I have a lot of that now, and I'll be playing bits and pieces of that over the next few months. It was kind of hard to select which one to play for the Glorious 12th itself. I finally selected this one. It's called the Armagh UVF Brigade, and it's by the Ulster Scots Flute Band. Okay, now there's something I want to mention here briefly, and it's something I've spoken of before, but I want to hit this topic again real quick because it's come up again in some of the contact that I've been having with some of you. Like so much of what I say on here, it sounds like I'm criticizing and berating some of you, but that's not the intention. I'm commenting on one kind of attitude and approach that some of us take towards our racial work. Kind of a character trait, which is very common and which has been ever since I've been in the movement, and it's one we're going to have to change. I'm not quite sure what to call it, maybe trivial pursuit, but anything that holds us back from realizing the 14 words isn't trivial. I'll give you the same example that I gave about 6 months ago when I think was when I mentioned this before, but there have been some others since then. I had a guy who was bombarding me with website links and quotes from books that he wanted me to talk about on this show, all of which had to do with the death of General George S. Patton in 1945. This guy was convinced that this was the secret to our ultimate victory if we could somehow just convince the bulk of white Americans that General Patton was murdered by the Jews in 1945 because he advocated uniting with the defeated Germany and marching right on Moscow to put an end to communism, then that would be just really bee's knees and that would just do the whole job for us. I'm honestly not sure why he thought that this one historical episode would be the one to resonate and catch fire in white Americans' minds over all the others that they've been ignoring for the past 60 years, if we could somehow make them aware of it, but he did. I'm not sure if, even in his own mind, he had any idea of what would happen if somehow we were able to sink it into the consciousness of the remaining white public that Patton was assassinated by the Jews. I guess he thought that angels would descend and cleanse the earth of scum in a chorus of hallelujahs or something of the kind. Now, to be sure, a very good case can, in fact, be made that General George Patton was murdered by somebody as part of a real-life, honest-to-God conspiracy. Two automobile accidents in one day is a little too unlucky for a coincidence in my mind. It's a genuine historical whodunit, and I can see why many people would find it interesting or even fascinating. But again, I'm just not certain why this comrade believed that Patton's admittedly probable murder was the turning point in history that he obviously felt it was, or how he thought that a general awareness of the facts of Patton's death might suddenly turn everything upside down when nothing else has. Now, thinking things through doesn't seem to be one of our strong suits. Like Colin Jordan once said, our white nationalist movement has a very big heart and a very small head. I've run across this single-issue pathology repeatedly, kind of like obsessive-compulsive disorder. People who take some obscure little incident or fact in history, like Patton, or the Bilderbergers, or Rockefeller, or some book or lengthy quote that was written or said 70 years ago by somebody famous, and they become obsessed with it to the point of irrationality, to the point where they disregard everything else. Now, some of the old articles that I have on file from other writers than myself down through the years are nothing more than long lists of quotes and references and footnotes to obscure works that nobody ever heard of over the past century. And if you ask these writers why, they'll tell you, why, this proves it, Harold! Proves it, I tells yous! And yeah, more often than not, that obscure little quote from Henry Ford or John Foster Dulles or some Jewish rabbi probably does prove it. That proof and $1.50 can get you a cup of watery coffee at McDonald's. Guys, for those among us who are still living in the 1950s in more ways than one, let me lay this out for you. The time for proving things and convincing people is largely gone. Not completely. Who knows? For one or two people, some proof that the Kikes had George Patton assassinated just might be the thing that really does wake them up. But that doesn't matter. What matters is what they do once they have been woken up. And if what they do is leap to their keyboards and start tapping, then there's not much point in the entire exercise. Guys, we are not trying to win an argument with the liberals or the media or anybody else. We are trying to change the world. So it doesn't matter what obscure little historical or scientific fact proves something or other, if nothing ever changes. The Northwest Imperative is unique in that alone among all white nationalist tendencies or organizations, our worldview is deed-based rather than word-based. It is centered around something that someone does rather than what someone says. Now, that necessary physical act is Northwest migration. You put your money and everything else where your mouth is by upping stakes and coming here, to the Northwest homeland, where you're supposed to be. And that is how every aspect of our political and racial work should be approached. Now, I'm not saying that we don't need to educate or convince people, but if they don't act once they're convinced, if they don't take the simple, legal, and ultimately beneficial step of Northwest migration, then we've frankly wasted our time. 20 million white people who have been awakened and know the score, and yet who do nothing, still amount to one big zero. Tell you what, I told Lord Lucan that I probably couldn't squeeze him in this week, but what the hell.
With the death of Michael Hastings, the journalist for Rolling Stone magazine, and the deliberate attempt on the life of Mike Harris, it is now obvious that America has become a third world country. It was in fact George Bush that said that the Constitution is a piece of paper. Yes, but he took a sworn oath to uphold what was written on that piece of paper. Alex Jones of Prison Planet is screaming that it is the work of the globalist bankers. Yes, and the international bankers are what? They are all Jews. In the city of Berlin, by means of a light show, the words United Stasi of America have appeared on the wall of the American embassy. And if you don't know what the Stasi is, it was the East German police. Yes, we are now living under a police state as bad as was East Germany. Yes, America has now become a communist country. People who still believe that America is a free country can now be classified as brain dead. The attempt on the life of Mike Harris was obviously the work of the government agency to make it look like an accident. As to the constant replacement of his breaking master cylinder, again, that has to be the work of some sort of paid hitman. It is now obvious that there is some sort of black operation going on in our government, just as it goes on in other third world countries. They are called death squads. So what can we do to stop the spread of these death squads? Well, and a well is a deep subject, that solution has to remain classified. Years ago, the Berlin Wall came down, and the events of Egypt are in the same category. 30 million demonstrators. And whose side was Obama on? He and our ambassador to Egypt were supporting the evil Muslim Brotherhood. Where Jesus said, broad and spacious is the road leading to destruction, and many are the ones on that road, whereas narrow and cramped is the road of life, and few of those are on that road. National socialism, in one word, means evolution. Therefore, in order to secure a future for the white race, we must be on the narrow road of evolution and only support other evolutionary movements. Islam is a backward Neanderthal caveman-type religion, the destruction of which should be in the same category as the other evil religion, Judaism. You must remember that it was Muhammad who said that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Just because Muslims hate Jews does not make Islam our friend. The last holy war came about as a result of the Eastern Orthodox Christians asking for the help of the Roman Catholics to fight against Islam. Now the Pope of the Coptic Christians is appealing for the military assistance of the West to save the Coptic Christians of Egypt from massacre by the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood is now murdering Christians in Egypt on a regular basis. Now if a holy war is to be fought against Islam, do we not have to fight against the Muslims that have already taken up residence in the Northwest? Yes, we have mosques right here in the Northwest. A Klansman once suggested to me that we should buy 200 Korans and make a bonfire out of them. In other words, we should do Koran lighting instead of cross lighting. So instead of saying the jig is up, we'll be saying the Hajj is up. Hajj is Arabic for pilgrim. Of course, meaning an Islamic pilgrim. Now, what is interesting about Obama's support for the Muslim Brotherhood is that his support clearly puts him on the opposite side of the Egyptian revolution and on the opposite side of Syria in Russia. Somehow Russia is now on the side of revolution against Islam, and America is supporting the tyranny of Islam. So why is that? America is ruled by Jewish globalists who are seeking the extermination of at least 90% of the world's population, and especially the armed portion of the white race, which represents the greatest threat to their globalist agenda. I overheard a conversation at a card table that said there are 6,000 Canadian troops at Fort Lewis, which is the largest army base on the West Coast. I have personally seen British troops driving down Interstate 5 near Tacoma, and they were driving their own British vehicles. Yes, their steering wheel is on the opposite side, so it seems their survival is in serious trouble. How many patriots do we have at a minute's notice that can fight against an army of obvious redcoats? So we have generals who are committing treason at Fort Lewis, because according to Conspiracy.com, they are coming to use foreign troops to disarm America, and the build-up of such disarmament is happening right now. So are we ready to fight such a war? Kerry says he will sign the United Nations Small Arms Treaty, and that means the United Nations troops that are stationed at Fort Lewis will then get the order to disarm American citizens. The Redcoats are coming. The Redcoats are coming. Well, according to Veterans Today, there are 8 million Americans on the terrorist watch list. Or to put it another way, 8 million Americans that the communists seek to exterminate once they have been able to disarm Americans. The presence of foreign troops on American soil is treason, since their real purpose is the dismantling of government for the people by the people. The other methods of dismantling our republic are vote fraud and the massive immigration which is taking place. That's just another form of vote fraud. We'll be right back.
And here's an Ulster folk classic for you. This is Sam Carson with the Protestant Boys.
Protestant boys are loyal and true, stout-hearted in battle and stout-handed too. The Protestant boys are true as of yore, and faithful and peaceful when danger is o'er. And though they bear and proudly wear the colors that floated o'er many a fray, where cannons were flashing and sabers were clashing, the Protestant boys still carry the day. Treason was rampant and traitors were strong, the law was defied by a vile rabble throng. When thousands were banded, the thrones were cast out, the Protestant rallied and stood by the crown. And often fight by day and night, they counted the rebels and managed a fray. When red packs were bristling and bullets were whistling, the Protestant boys still carried the day. When James half a bigot and more of a knave, with masses and Frenchmen the land would enslave, the Protestant boys for liberty drew, and showed with the orange their banner of blue. And very well their might can tell, who first in their ranks did the orange display. The Boyne had no shires, and not from no flyer, the Protestant boys still carried the day. And still does the fame of their glory remain, unclouded by age and undimmed by a stain. Forever and ever their cause we'll uphold, the cause of the true and the trusted and bold. And scorn to yield or quit the fate, where over our head the old colours shall play. And traitors shall tremble whene'er we assemble, for Protestant boys still carry the day. Protestant boys are loyal and true, though vices are changed and the loyal are few. The Protestant boys are true to the last, though powers belie them when danger has passed. For still we stand a loyal band, and write not the liars whatever they say. Just let the drums rattle and summons for battle, the Protestant boys can carry the day.
Email from Sue in Raleigh. Dear HAC, you talk about the need to attract young people, Harold, but we have the key already in our hands to bringing in as many high-quality applicants, or whatever you want to call them, as we can handle. I am referring to your 5 Northwest novels. Now, I know that trying to get anyone under 30 to sit down and read a book is like pulling teeth, but if we could get 100,000 copies of each book into print, and 1 million more onto the internet, and somehow drag these white kids kicking and screaming to the point where they will sit down and read them, then I think we've got it licked. The Northwest idea will be so deeply entrenched in the minds of youngsters that all the dictator's horses and all the dictator's men won't ever be able to dig or rip it out of them. By George, I think she's got it! Yeah, that's why I wrote them. I have a question for some of you people out there who might be in a position to know. Does anyone actually read books on Kindle or other electronic formats, especially young white people? Now, the way I figure it is, if they've become so used to getting all their input from an electronic screen, then maybe that's the way to go. But is it possible to get white kids to read at all? I think it may be, if it can be made clear to them somehow, going in, that they are reading something which is genuinely forbidden by authority, and which will shock and horrify their parents and adults in general. Adolescents are always looking for some way to do that, and the body piercings and the purple hair probably don't cut the mustard in that department anymore. So, if anyone knows anything relevant here, or if you can find me something online that has some statistical analysis on this, please let me know. But we're running long again, so our time is up now. So that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha on the Bon. Freedom.
Still is beating heart.